Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest this morning is Amy Wilson, author and performer of the off-Broadway hit Motherlode. According to Amy, after 7 years of raising kids, she has an overriding daily thought: she sucks at being a mother. Amy and I will be discussing her new book, When Did I Get Like This?, her funny, endearing celebration of a mother's quest to provide what is best for her kids in the age of too many options. Good morning, Amy. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, wonderful. I love reading your book. Glad to have you on today. Currently being single and not having children yet, your book gave me some second thoughts about family life, you know?
That's what I hear. That's what I hear sometimes, which is not my intent, but I can see why that might happen.
I say, this is strictly from a guy's perspective now, so but I'm just kidding. I enjoy family. I think as I get older, it starts to stick to me in terms of wanting to have family and so forth, but it's just wonderful because it gave me a chance to look back at me growing up, being taken care of by my mom, and my gosh, what she went through. Now, I have...
Isn't that true? We have no idea. We have no idea what our mothers did for us at the time.
Precisely. No kidding. And so even in my book, I try to capture that motherly love as best as I can based on what they told me. And so this is very, very interesting. But I like your candid way of sharing your family life, motherhood. It's funny, hilarious, and what I like about it, it has a nice, wonderful touch of tenderness at the very end of it, and that was very nicely done, and so I thought it was a beautiful piece of work overall, so that's very,
Thank
very exciting.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, let us get started by having you tell us a little bit about yourself. Amy, please walk us through your life's journey from childhood to the present moment.
I grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is a very bucolic sort of suburb, the kind of thing that doesn't necessarily exist anymore, where kids just go out and play after school and you come home and the church bells ring at 10 after 6. And life was easy and lovely, and we didn't go to camp and we didn't have 18 after school activities. I was the oldest of six kids. I am the oldest of six kids. And so from a very early age, I was changing diapers and feeding bottles and babysitting. And so I always knew I wanted to be a mother. That was number one. And number two, I always figured I was going to be very good at it, that I knew how to take care of kids. There are new mothers who never hold a newborn until it's their own. Well, that wasn't me. So I figured I was going to be very good at this. And even though I had sort of overthought and been a perfectionist about some other things in my life, motherhood would be when I finally relaxed because I could handle it. Well, how wrong I was, of course, as I came to find out. I had two little boys 19 months apart, and then their little sister 3 years later. And, I've loved every day of it, but there have also been parts of every day when I have been sure that I'm just so bad at this, that I'm doing everything wrong, and that other people are doing it so much better than me. And I think that I'm not alone in feeling that way. I've discovered that as mothers, we all have these feelings of self-doubt and these insecurities. Even when we're not used to, we're people who are used to being good at things and used to figuring things out, motherhood just does not, especially modern motherhood, does not lend itself to that sort of perfectionism. It will only reward you with feeling bad about yourself.
That's true. And I'm glad you brought about the context of modern motherhood and perhaps, say, older generations, because each generation has its wonderful touch of motherhood. But we'll touch back on that a little bit later. I do want to ask you about this. Growing up, when did you discover your ability to be an actress and obviously a wonderful writer?
I always wanted to be an actress. You know, like little kids want to be a firefighter or an astronaut,
right,
or a ballerina. I wanted to be an actress ever since I can remember. Maybe I wanted to be an Olympic gymnast for maybe one summer, but the rest of the time I wanted to be an actress. And, you know, to my parents' credit, they they, on the one hand, they didn't, you know, take me to auditions and turn into stage parents or any of that nonsense. I think they thought I'd change my mind and grow out of it eventually. But neither did they say, oh, that you can't really be that and you have to be something else. They never discouraged me. I think I was just always so sure of myself. They just sort of stood back and said, okay, let's see. And I went off to college for acting and ended up getting somewhere. I mean, it's a very difficult business, but I ended up forging a career for myself and really being proud of what I accomplished. But it was not compatible with having kids. I was in L.A. and my husband was in New York, actually, and one of us had to move. And even when you're a successful actor, it's not the most secure of professions. Your show gets canceled and then you're unemployed for 2 years. So I moved home to New York and decided we would start a family. And that's when I found out being a mom was going to be a lot harder than I had ever imagined.
what role did your mom play when you were, in your success as far as, the things that you were pursuing? Because as you had mentioned just now, one thing is very interesting. People, we all go through this, even like me, when we want to be something. And then, of course, our parents are like, what? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, they never did that, but neither did they say, like, you go for it, honey, you believe your dream. There were six of us, and I was the oldest, and I think it just was like I needed to take care of myself. I understood that from an early age. I wasn't going to get in trouble. I wasn't going to get arrested or pregnant or steal a car or whatever. That was, I was going to take care of myself. My parents had my brothers and sisters to worry about. And so I just was very independent-minded, and when I said I wanted to be an actress, I think they just sort of thought, like, oh, okay, well, I'm sure she'll change her mind one of these days. Because I was smart. I did well in school, and there were definitely some people who would have said, I'm sure, well, I know I had some high school teachers who did say that would be certainly a waste of my intelligence. Now, I don't agree with that at all, but there were people who thought that. So they heard those opinions, but to their credit, stood back and let me be what I wanted to be, even at a young age.
That's wonderful. I view life as a buffet line. You pick and choose.
Mm-hmm.
Taste things, and if you like it, go back for seconds. And you don't, move on.
That's right. And that's a good way to think of things. It may help you let go of outcomes a little bit, I would imagine, right? This is just a new adventure and you see how it goes.
Yeah, and one thing, you're right, because my parents did allow me to do that in terms of tasting so many things, and then they figured that eventually I'll figure out, what I like and don't like, and then pursue it accordingly. Growing up, for most girls, they have a certain amount of vision about what married life and, of course, having family is like. What was your take? I know you have always felt like, hey, I'm a great mother and this and that. What's your take about this sort of whole package, so to speak, when you were growing up?
I had a very traditional upbringing in that my mom stayed home with us and my dad went off to work each morning. And that certainly worked for me. I mean, as a kid, that makes you pretty happy to have somebody home every morning. I mean, there every morning when you leave for school and there every day when you get home from school. And so, and being an actress also, I mean, it's kind of incompatible to be an actress and have a baby, while you're gaining and losing your 50 pounds of pregnancy weight. You're pretty uncastable. So I knew there was going to be built-in time when I was going to be home with my kids, and I really looked forward to that. That was something that I really wanted to do, that I thought was important, and I loved it. But it is hard. It is hard to leave behind, as I think many women do who make this choice. You leave behind a career that you've spent 5, 8, 10 years building, and it very quickly sails away without you. I mean, it's just true in our society that the on-ramps for women who take time off to have kids and then try to come back into their careers are not easy. There is a cost to that. And I started writing. I'd always been writing other material for myself to perform, but I started writing Motherload because I just was frustrated that I hadn't acted in several years and I had an opportunity. Somebody asked me if I'd write a solo show and perform it, and I thought, well, I'm going to write about motherhood because that's what I'm living right now. I had a almost 3-year-old and a baby at the time, so I could write about that. Was writing about my daily experience, and it very quickly turned into a whole new a stage of my life. As you were saying about the buffet table, I moved on to something else, and all of a sudden, I was writing articles for parenting magazines, and I was writing the book, and my post children career has sort of morphed into more of a writer than an actress, which thrills me. I could not have predicted it, that it would come out this way, but I'm certainly happy that it has.
Well, what I see, too, is that you brought that comical side of things. You obviously grew up as a happy child, and so you have a different look at things, and I pretty much grew up from that perspective where we look at humor in so many different things because maybe in some ways we were looking to cheer ourselves up. So even though amidst those frustration because life doesn't actually pause for us to take a little time out, I mean, it's like I envision like when we were running a marathon that even though we take a little water break, well, guess what? The race is on, and so it's up
right.
to us to kind of catch up to make sure that we didn't fall back too far. But the way you have this wonderful comical touch about motherhood experience with Motherload, how is that compared to the way your mom brought you guys up in her age in time?
I think that every mother tries to do the best that they can. Every mother wants what's best for her children. I mean, of course she does. But I do think in my mother's day, you did your best and you slept at night. You know what I mean? You did the best you can do, and that was all that was to be expected, really. You know, and sometimes you have your back turned and your kid falls down, and or that kind of thing. Or sometimes you have pizza for dinner. It's all right. Everybody does that. Or I have three kids. I'm not supposed to wear a bikini anymore. Like that's who would wear a bikini after they had children? It just was a different time in that way. Now the standards have just slowly gotten higher and higher and higher over time.
Right.
And so now we beat ourselves up if we're not Heidi Klum and back on the beach six weeks later. And everything we do for our kids, we have to sort of overthink. And doing our best just really isn't good enough. We're just so much more aware of all the ways that we're falling short, which I don't think is our fault. I think we're made aware of these things every time we turn on the TV or the computer or read a book or talk to our friends. And I don't think those pressures were present in all our mothers' lives in the same way. And so I think raising kids was hard no matter when you did it, but this feeling bad about yourself aspect is a whole new a set of rocks in your backpack, if you know what I'm saying, that our mothers didn't have.
Well, one thing for sure is that I think the motherhood in itself, the core taking care of your child as your child being the most important thing in your life for at the very least, they go through phases. For the first 18 years, they try to be the best teacher. As a mother, you want to be the best teacher, and then eventually you evolve to being the best coach and then eventually being a best counselor. But having said that, I don't think that changes very much from then versus now. What has happened is that back then, you don't have all this sort of public pressure, the peer pressure, as you said, because you are confined within a certain community that basically when you look around everywhere, everybody is pretty much the same. Here in the age of multimedia, and that comes back to modern motherhood versus then, you're looking at a totally different challenge. And so you have to have that balancing act of being able to balance both sides of the equation. Plus, not to mention, perhaps back then they were pretty much perhaps maybe a full-time mother. And so you can achieve a lot more things done versus, say, now you have a balancing act about being a good mother and at the same time maintaining your career. What's your take on that?
I'm sorry, say the question again?
The question would be the balancing act of motherhood and career, because that's what you are having to balance. I mean, the challenge for you versus, say, for them at that time.
Right. I do think it's hard, but in some ways I think at least for me it's easier. Like I realized writing this book last summer, I had a very compressed deadline for writing the first draft of this book because that's just the way the publishing industry works. They need a lot of lead time for the manuscript to be passed around. So I only had about 4 months to write the first draft, and I had to work on it in a very concentrated way, say 4 or 5 hours every day, and then I'd put it down and spend the rest of the day. I'd work from 9 to 1 or 2 and then put it down and be with the kids for the rest of the afternoon. And I was a great mom last summer when I was doing that. You know what I mean? I mean, when I was absent every morning But every afternoon, I was so calm, so patient, so happy. It was like I was going out and running 10 miles every morning. I felt so good about myself. Even when the writing hadn't been that good that day, I still had spent several hours doing something that really excited me, that I was really passionate about, that wasn't, you know, making the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches have perfect crustless corners, which just, let's face it, is not that fulfilling for anyone. When I think when that's all you have to measure your success, you can only be disappointed because the standards are so high, and you can never be the perfect mother, but you can be a pretty good writer. It's easier to be good at writing than to be perfect at mothering. And I found taking that time each day to have something else that I loved, I could then come back to them much more full and ready to concentrate on them. And so I think in some ways that's easier than for moms who don't do anything else but, and who really do overthink the cupcakes or the soccer drop off, because it's easy to, we're told to. I mean, I don't look down. I don't mean to be snide about those things, because we all overthink those things, because we're all, it's made quite clear to us we're supposed to overthink those things. But when you have something else that matters to you, which I don't think we always allow ourselves to have, I think we think we should feel guilty about enjoying running or writing or playing tennis once in a while. But I think those things actually make us a better mother. So for me, the balance that I've been able to find of being with the little kids and writing, I think I'm very privileged. It's made me a better mother and a better writer than when I was just one or the other.
Would you feel like your writing is an outlet for your motherhood anxiety, so to speak, because you're able to compartmentalize it and say, you know, hey, this is my time, and being able to sort of like get switched around, and you know, that's your personal time.
Yeah, I mean, that's all part of it too. Of course, the writing that I'm doing is reflecting on what kind of mother I am and what kind of mother I want to be, and what's the difference. I feel so fortunate that I've gotten to spend some time thinking about that, because yes, I do think it's improved my mothering. It's not like the lessons that I've learned about how counterproductive it is to spend your time worrying about these silly little nonsense things that can take up all your time when you're a mom, how much that just gets in the way of being with your kids and enjoying them. I've come to figure that out through writing about it, and I've come to really work hard at not being that mom, and I'm not sure that I would have had that realization had I not had that time to write about it and think about it.
How does your husband fit into all of this?
He's so supportive. I dedicated the book to him because he's totally supportive. Of course, many times last summer when I was panicking, I'd never finish the book in time, or that it was going to be a terrible failure. He was there and would get up with the kids. One other way I'd write is I'd get up very early on Saturday and Sunday mornings. I'd go to the Starbucks at 6:30, whenever it opened. And then I'd get home by, say, 9:30 or 10, and I'd have done my writing for the day, and the kids wouldn't really know the difference. But that meant he and I couldn't take turns on the weekend mornings like we like to do. He had to be up every morning, too. And he was totally supportive of the book, and as he is of all my artistic endeavors. And he's a great dad. He works really long hours. He's not home very much during the week. And I think that's a not uncommon experience for families these days, too. Sometimes one, sometimes both parents are working 70 hours a week, and it does make things hard.
What you just mentioned is a wonderful balancing act of something that's happening now in modern day family life, which is good because you have a whole lot more synergy of family. I guess maybe during the times of our parents, actually, you do have the separation of the two roles, and now you have a very different take, which is just wonderful. One of the things that I obviously got from reading your book that you had a fairly challenging anxiety, so to speak, with your first child. Do you think the fact that you went through all that sort of added more pressure of the fact that you needed to be that perfect mom, so to speak?
I think it did. I mean, in our generation as a whole, we wait later to have kids. And so, you know, there's a lot more build up. And for me, yeah, it took me about a year and a half to get pregnant, and lots of testing and shots and everything else. And I do think, yes, that added to this baby is so important. This baby was so hard won that I cannot mess this up. I can't do anything wrong. So now everything has to be perfect for this, you know, wonderful, such desired baby. And so, I do think that made it a little worse. I probably would have been like this anyway, but it certainly didn't help.
Well, I mean, you are a perfectionist and an overplanner.
That's right.
So that coupled with everything and, of course, the anxiety of the first child and the degree of what you guys went through to have the first child, do you think that being a perfectionist and an overplanner does affect your judgment in being a good mother?
Yeah, I think it can get in the way. I mean, it doesn't always have to get in the way. It doesn't have to always be a bad thing, but I would say it often is. It just doesn't apply. The time that you spend making your children's lives perfect, you're just missing their childhood. They don't care, is what I've come to realize. And it was a friend who didn't have kids that pointed this out to me. I was saying something about, oh, and I gave the kids hot dogs for dinner or whatever it was I was, you know, complaining about. And she said, but I bet the kids love having hot dogs for dinner. And it's, you know, they do. And it kind of dawned on me the things that I beat myself up the most about. They're staying up too late. I got to get them to bed sooner. They're not getting enough vitamins or whatever, all the things that we beat ourselves up over. To my kids, like having hot dogs for dinner and then staying up late, that's awesome. That's as good as it gets. And that was an interesting
thing. You're a great mom having
kids. Yeah, what a wonderful mom.
That,
now,
you know?
Of course, you can't do everything the kids want. They wouldn't grow up very healthy. But that was interesting to me. Like they don't care. They don't care. They would love it much more if I didn't care what was for dinner and stayed outside in the yard playing with them for another 20 minutes. That's what they want from me, not this perfect life that I'm trying to create for them, which is not possible. Once I really internalized that idea, I think my parenting really changed for the better.
Did you draw anything from your mom from that perspective when you talk about parenting ideas and so forth?
Lots of people will ask me, you know, they'll say, so everybody says I'm going to do this so differently from my mom. What was it for you? I didn't feel that way at all. I had a very unflappable, patient, calm mother who you know, I think maybe lost her marbles two or three times growing up. not too often. I can remember one time she yelled at us all that nobody was helping her with anything. She had five children at the time, and she was yelling that, like, we never, you know, nobody ever helped her. And this is probably like 14 years coming, this you know, this breakdown. I think I have a breakdown like that about once a week. But she was so unflappable and so safe in that way. And I try to be as much like her as possible. I find the more I am like her, the better I'm doing. There are times when I sweat the small stuff and I start to get really worried that we're 3 milliseconds late for the school bus or whatever, and I try to let go. And my kindergarten teacher says something. I mean, my kindergarten teacher, my kid's kindergarten teacher, when somebody hurts themselves or they're going to tattle on somebody, they'd come over to her and she'd say, "Is this a big deal or a little deal?" And of course, they usually say, "It's a little deal," and they walk away and they go back to playing. And I've really tried to take that over also in my life. We're late for the school bus. Is this a big deal or a little deal?
Mm-hmm.
It's a little deal, right? And so I don't have to yell, I don't have to scream, I don't have to, you know, threaten them if they don't have their shoes on in 10 seconds or else. It just, you can just let go a little bit and we'll all be better off. And that's really helped me to get that perspective.
Well, how many books, self-help, mother stuff that you expose yourself or read about and everything else, and does it work?
I read, well, when I was actually like having my first child, I read every baby book. I read all of them, which I do not recommend as a thing to do. Because of course, they're completely contradictory, some of them. Some say you need to get your baby on a schedule by 8 weeks. Some say if you ever try to get your baby on a schedule, you're a horrible person, and everything in between. So I think you need to choose your experts a little more carefully than I did. I think the experts are probably your friends, your sisters, the one right next to you. In my case, I didn't really have any friends who had just had babies, and I'm the oldest. And in so many ways, my mother couldn't help me with breastfeeding. She doesn't know anything about breastfeeding. Neither does my mother-in-law. And that was a totally new adventure. And in that case, you really do have to sort of seek out friends or support groups or things like that, because it's not our parents' fault. A lot of them just don't have the insight in that particular area.
Well, no one is an expert in everything, So that's the.
Well, that's true. But you're the expert. You know what I came to understand is, you know, by about 8 weeks in, you are the expert on your baby. You do know that when your baby cries like this, it means X more than any book ever could. And
right.
And to trust yourself that the Dr. Spock, Baby and Child Care, which is sort of a classic but sort of fallen by the wayside now, but that's the first sentence of that book. It says, trust yourself. You know more than you think you do. I don't. My mother had that book around. I didn't read that book. It's probably the only one I didn't read, and I should have read only that one because all the other ones just, I think, set out to tell you why you're doing everything wrong and how your only hope is to listen to them. And, you know, I don't think that's true. You just end up overthinking.
It sounds like you're right, because then you have an information overload, and which is the best? And then you're trying to create a third book, so to speak, because you're trying to combine the best of all the things you have read. And
right.
Is it practical?
Right. I mean, you can be pretty sure of something, and then reading the book something opposite, like, oh, well, I thought my baby, when he was 5 months old, really still needed to be eating at night, and that was okay. But now that this book tells me that I'm just a lazy mother for not sleep training him, then I guess I feel bad about that. You can get off path. These experts can actually take you off the path and further away from what you know to be true.
You wrote something, which is, I know you meant it in a beautiful sort of a funny way, that sometimes you feel like you're back home to the prison, so to speak. And it was very interesting because you look like you tied up in a situation, oh my gosh, okay, now I've compartmentalized this, now I'm going back to prison, so to speak. Can you just give us your thought about that?
Yeah, that was, I wrote that about my son Connor had reflux, and he just cried all the time. This was one of those babies that cried all the time, and I couldn't really go anywhere with him because he just would scream something. I'd go to a restaurant with him in the baby car seat, he'd be asleep, we'd order, he'd wake up and start screaming, and there would be nothing I could do for him when he cried like that. Everybody would be just staring at me like, you know, give him a pacifier, he wouldn't take one. Well, you know, nurse him, he didn't want to nurse, he just wanted to scream, and I'd have to leave. And even taking him to the drugstore, I talk about this in the book, but even taking him to the drugstore became this grim thing I had to do, that he'd start crying while I was in the checkout line, and I'd have to run out before he even got my receipt because he just, you know, was really starting to bellow and frighten everyone around. And I did at that time feel like, yeah, I'm at home. It was winter time, and I had a screaming baby who, you know, terrified everyone, including me, and here I was stuck home with him. And I thought, you think, what have I done? And you also think, it will always be like this. You know, a sleep-deprived new mother usually doesn't have the perspective of, oh, another 2 months of this and it'll all be a distant memory. You think, it will always be this way. This is my fault. There must be some reason he's doing this, and it must be something I'm doing wrong. And you can really, go some dark places inside of your head sometimes. I try to be funny about it in the book, and it is funny now, but it wasn't so funny while I was living through it.
But it was good because you were able to kind of put it a lot of humor and fun into your writing, because
thanks.
When you look at that, what came to mind for me is that a lot of times the outside people looking in say, oh my gosh, like you were talking about going to the grocery store and all of a sudden Connor starts yelling or crying or whatever, they're not looking at a kid, they're looking at you.
That's right.
And saying like, what the heck did she just do? Or is she
right?
Is she
what's wrong
mom?
With that mother that she can't quiet that baby down? Yeah,
there
and
you go. Yeah. Yeah.
And you try to block that out, and it doesn't always work.
Right, right. And so those are the pressure that it's put on, because that's real. That's real life, real situation. And, you and I have the same thing. I mean, maybe not as you as a mom now that you realize that that's not necessarily the responsibility of the mom or the mom's fault that something like that happened. But say for me who know nothing about that, I'm looking at the adult, not the child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's another story in the book I talk about taking my three kids by myself on the on an airplane, and Maggie had my baby had a stomach flu, which did not become manifest until we were already on the plane, and she threw up 8 times on the flight. She threw up once. I got herself and me, I got her all cleaned up. And as soon as we sat back down on the seat, she threw up again all over everything I just changed her into. I was out of clean outfits. I was out of things to clean us up with. And everybody, the flight attendants, the people sitting around us, were all staring at me like, what is wrong with that woman that she can't get her baby to stop throwing up? And
right.
It was horrible. And I look back on it now. again, now it's a good story. At the moment, it was just horrifying. And I also spent, I wish I didn't, but I spent half of that flight feeling bad that I was ruining these people's flights because my baby was throwing up instead of giving all my attention to my sick baby. You know what I'm saying? Like, what a waste of time that I'm worrying about what the lady in front of me thinks. Who cares? My baby's throwing up, and, you know, and she was at that age where you can't even, she doesn't even understand what's happening. Even my baby was looking at me like, why aren't you doing something about this? Stop this, mommy. Stop me from throwing up. It was something else, but I will say my boys had their headphones on. We were flying JetBlue, and so they were watching Cartoon Network with their headphones on, and this was happening right next to them on the entire flight, and they didn't even notice.
They couldn't care less. You know, that's mommy's
problem. Yeah, they just were watching SpongeBob, and it was only when we were getting off the plane. I guess he was 6 years old at the time, maybe even five, and he looked up, and he's like, what is that smell, Mom? And he didn't notice for the whole flight what was happening in the seat next to him. But everybody else did, that's for sure.
But you have a wonderful sense of humor, though, to be able to.
Well, you know, even while it was happening, like, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I didn't know I was going to write a book about it, but I thought, oh, my God, I cannot wait until I get off this plane and this is over and I'm going to call David and, oh, my, like, you just think, boy, is this a story I'm going to tell later. And I don't know, that helps me get through moments like this. Like, this is a story. This is a good one. And if you can laugh at it. If you can laugh at it while it's happening, that's even a little better. I can't say I laughed at it, but I was aware that this was going to be a story I'd be telling for a long time.
I want to go back to the time when you first had Connor and you used the idea about scheduling, baby schedule and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that, because I thought that was really interesting, and it sort of reminded me about the fact that what I actually wrote in my book in terms of what I understand how mom goes through, where they watch us like a hawk as a baby, as a child. So please tell us your side of the equation here.
About trying to get
using
a baby
schedule,
on a schedule?
Yeah, those kind of things. Yeah, the concept behind it and how you had a wonderful way from a mom perspective, you know.
Yeah, it becomes a battle. I had decided my youngest, I think she was probably 10 months old. Like, okay, she's going to sleep through the night. And my husband, you know, he was definitely feeding me, like, this is ridiculous. You were letting this go on too long. And I'm off to work now. And, you know, and I was the one getting up with her because he didn't hear or pretended not to hear her. You'll hear some mothers will have strong opinions on whether their husbands are really sleeping through all that crying or not. But, he's like, you need to do something about this. And he was right. I did. Or, you know, somebody did, and it was me. And, it just was not going well. I tried this, it didn't work. I tried that, it didn't work. And you start to really think, it's like Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner. You start to think, like, this little thing is outwitting me, and they're a baby, and I am a grown-up, and I'm the boss here. And you just get outwitted everything you try. You can let them cry for 2 hours, and then you cave because you can't take it anymore, and you bring them in your bed, and then they look at you like, ah, I got you. And you're right back at square one. And you think, damn, but too late then. Too late then. They've won again.
Well, what's interesting about that is that you obviously spent a lot of quality time just observing your child, and you knew your child inside out, and they don't even realize that. And the reason why I brought that particular point up is because I came to the United States, and I was away from my mom for about, my gosh, around 8 years or so. And when I came here, I was 18, so you add 8 years gives you another number.
Mm-hmm.
But the point what I was trying to make was, and I got into this thing with one of my friends, and my mom that came over during that time within the 2 months or so, and said, well, you know, I know my son. I know Johnny. And it just dawned on me, like, wait a minute, you haven't seen me for 8 years.
Yeah.
And that doesn't matter because she knows me, because she knows my little things here that I'm doing as a child. And it reminded me of that when you were talking about the baby schedule. I just wanted to mention
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they know. I mean, it is true. It gives you so much, being a parent, you have so much new compassion for for your mother and what they know. And you know, why my mother cried when they dropped me off at college the first day, right? And I was like, goodbye, Mom. Like, what are you crying for? Whatever, I'll be home in a couple months. Now, of course, now I understand. Now I see. But you see it in a new way once you become a parent yourself.
It's very different. So I when reading your book, it really, I enjoyed it because it's sort of like I put myself in this situation where I am the child And like you are my mom. I'm not, no offense mm-hmm. here, you know, just sort of that, you know, like, oh, wow, this is what she saw. This is what she experienced.
Right, right. Oh, thanks. That's nice. I'm glad that it worked in that way.
Yeah, so it was very, very different. In the Tales of Two Mummies,
mm-hmm.
you used the choice word bowl, and I really like that very much. Please elaborate about that.
Oh, yeah. So when I was growing up, my mother never said, called us a bad girl or a bad boy. She just, that never came out of her mouth. She'd say we were bold. Like, that's don't be bold, or hey, that was bold when you did that. Don't be a bold girl. And she just said that. And so I just grew up with that, and I kind of thought everybody did that. And I was at playgroup with my, you know, my new friends, and Connor was crawling around on the floor, my first, and I said, don't you be a bold boy. And everybody kind of looked at me like, what? What do you mean bold? Like brazen? What do you mean? I said, I don't know. Don't you guys? Nobody ever said that. So I thought that was kind of nice, because there was always safety there. Even when my mother is so gentle, even when she was reprimanding me, I don't think she called me bad once in my life. You know, bold was sort of as far as she needed to go. And that felt safe in a way. Like, okay, my mother still loves me. I need to get my act together, but I'm not a bad person. I'm a bold person. That's okay. I can fix that quickly. And so I say that to my kids too. I definitely have taken it on, and I've discovered that it's sort of an Irish thing. Now I'm of Irish descent, so my mother didn't know that, I don't think, but that's where it comes from. It's an Irish thing to call kids bad kids, bulls. and when my 3-year-old, he was 3 turning 4, he just was at that stage that every parent knows, they go through good stages and bad stages, and he was just a little nightmare. He just was a nightmare. And in desperation one night, I told him he had that good Seamus lived on one shoulder and bold Seamus lived on the other shoulder, and they're both whispering in his ear and telling him how to behave, and he needs to listen to good Seamus. And this really spoke to him for some reason, and he really, really liked it. And then my older son one night said, Mom, you know how there's a good Seamus and a bold Seamus? And I said, sure. He said, there's also, you know, there's also a good mommy and a bold mommy. And then he kind of, he was in the bathtub. I was washing him. And then he's like, there's a good mommy, and then there's sometimes a bold mommy, too. And then he kind of, like, disappeared under the water. He kind of hid in the bathtub. Let me take
that
in.
One. I like that.
And, yeah, I mean, so that hit me. Like, that knocked me over. And a friend of mine said, well, if he felt like he could say it, you can't be that bad. If he felt like he could say it at all, then you're bold. You're not bad, because he's safe enough to tell you that he feels that way.
Right.
But I felt so bad that he felt that way, that there were sort of two of me, and that one or the other might show up on a particular morning. And, you know, I've been working on that. I'm trying to be more even-keeled of temper, but there are definitely days when bold mommy comes out and I'm not so nice. But that's true of all of us, I suppose. Maybe not my mom, but most of the rest of us, I think, have our moments.
Mm-hmm. I think we all do. I think our moms do too, but we don't see it, or we ignore it as a child.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, or maybe I don't remember. I'm starting to try to tell myself that maybe I just don't remember that, because I do look back at my mom as just being, she could never do any wrong. And it's hard to live up to sometimes. So I hope I'm maybe putting a bucolic spin on it. I don't know. Maybe.
Well, it's one of those moments that they either run into the kitchen or in the closet and excuse me for just a minute and just let yell.
Right.
And then come back.
I do give myself a time out sometimes. That's a very, useful mm-hmm. technique for
mm-hmm.
sure.
At any point, do you feel overwhelmed?
Oh, every day. I mean, absolutely. Like, yes, at least once a day I feel overwhelmed, and I can't do this. And in some ways my life is so much easier than my mom's. I have a babysitter who comes part of the day, and so I can take just one kid out to learn to ride his bike, or just one kid to soccer, and you know, and I have a cleaning lady come once a week, and my life in some ways is so much easier than my mom's, who is doing all of that stuff herself. But there's just so much to worry about, and our lives are just more complicated than they used to be, and probably needlessly so. And so, yeah, it's still at least once a day, I think, I cannot get all this done. Oh. And just when you think you do, that's when
yeah.
your kid comes home like, oh, Mom, we have the class mascot for the weekend, and we have to make a scrapbook of everything we do. Just when you get your head above water, one of your kids will, you know, throw up or come home with a project or fall off their bike or whatever. You can't plan for the unpredictable. That's what motherhood is all
right.
about.
Right. You basically have to go with the flow.
You have to go with the flow, right? And when something crazy happens to upturn everything, you say like, oh, there it is. I knew this was coming. Yeah, you do. That's exactly what you have to do.
Are you as funny and hilarious with your kids?
I try to. I try to make them laugh. I do silly things. Like, I remember their teacher at school, we were talking about what this age group is like, and she said, now, of course, this age is into potty humor, and, of course, you must never make them, they'll be doing it, you must never, ever laugh at it yourself. And I thought, like, uh-oh, too late. I'm totally into potty humor and burping and saying somebody else did it or whatever. I do probably too much of that with my kids, so probably in over my head there. But, yeah, I try to make them laugh. I think they think I'm more goofy than funny, probably, but they humor me.
Robin Williams, one of the things that in one of the interviews, when they interviewed him and people that really know him, you know, he's a funny guy, stand up as well as an actor. And one of the things that the children really don't know who the real Robin Williams is. And I felt like maybe, you know, that's him. That's who he is. That's the real him. Do you feel that way in some ways?
I mean, I can see that being true of him. No, I mean, I'm not necessarily that funny in real life. Uh-huh. I'm not like Jim Carrey or Robin Williams. I think sometimes people are surprised when they read my book that it's funnier than they thought I was. So exactly. I don't try to make every minute a laugh riot. So, for better or worse, maybe it'd be nicer if I did, but no, I don't think that's a problem particularly. I'd like to think I'm very connected to my kids and that they feel that they
right.
feel very, very safe and very, very connected to me, and that I really listen to them. That's what I try to give them as a gift.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that they would someday say that about me. We'll see. I'm sure their memoir is coming.
But that's who you are in a way, because you are just it's not acting. The acting is to act something that's not you, or act a role that's not you. But this is who you are. And I think, like what I was just mentioning just now about Robin Williams, where I believe as a person, that's who he is. He's naturally humorous, funny. He looks at the world or situations in a very different way. He finds humor in everything, you know, that's going on, and I believe that's in you in some ways. That doesn't mean that we don't have our serious moments, but you're very quick to switch, I guess, real quickly, flip the switch and say, you know, hey, that's a lot of humor in this. It's funny.
Right, right. I do think that humor can be a great distraction tactic with kids, particularly, like a kid having a meltdown. You can sort of head it off at the pass.
Right.
If you can make them giggle, so I definitely try to use that technique often, I would say.
Fantastic. Well, looking back, if you have a chance to do it all over again, what would you have done differently as a mother?
I think I would have. I would just come to this conclusion sooner about overthinking things was a waste of time. I'm not sure. Like, I'd like to think that people could read this book and save themselves some trouble. You know what I mean? Like somebody who's not a parent yet or pregnant with their first could read this and say, okay, not going to do that. Not going to go into the hospital with a typed up birth plan that this is exactly how my birth has to go, because the nurses laugh at you and it doesn't, no birth has ever gone exactly the way it was supposed to go. And
wow.
It's okay to have preferences. I'm not saying that. It's certainly okay to be informed. It's not okay to feel it has to go this perfect way or else you have failed somehow, which is how I felt. And I'd like to think that somebody pregnant with her first child could read this and say, okay, good, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to waste my time doing these things. Although sometimes I do wonder if you can save somebody maybe you have to go on that journey yourself, if you know what I'm saying. Maybe you really can't just sort of say, okay, I won't do that. You might have to actually live it to learn not to do it. I'm not sure about that. So while I'd like to say I'd like to go back and be a more calm and relaxed parent from the beginning. Maybe that's not possible. So maybe I shouldn't be too hard on myself about it. In other words,
you are by nature a perfectionist and over planner. So that is a personality trait. It's got nothing to do with the child, I think, in some ways, because a child, I mean, from a crude standpoint of view, is one of the projects you're working on, and you want it
that's
to be the
true.
Project to see.
Although I will say that being a perfectionist actually served me, you know, pretty well in the rest of my life. That going after You know, as a writer, it can serve you pretty well if it doesn't make you so you can't write at all. It makes you work very hard, not settle for less. As an actor, I think it got me somewhere because I was sort of unwilling to give up. But yeah, when it comes to parenthood, that's where you meet your match as a perfectionist. You cannot be a perfect mother, and the more you try, the more gloriously you will fail.
The perfectionism comes in from a standpoint of focusing on going with the flow. You have to have certain sets of perimeters, but then you have to go with the flow too.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Right, because things are not going to go. So that's what matters, and I think I try to come to that by the end of the book. But that's what matters. When some curveball is thrown at you and your baby starts throwing up on you on the plane, that's what's going to make you a great mother. How do you react to that? How do you stay in the moment and stay calm and get through it however you have to? Doing that at all means you're a terrific mother.
That's right. Staying in the moment and applying all the knowledge that you have, the talent and the skills to handle the situation at hand.
That's right.
Much. How did any roles from the grandparents?
My mother and my mother-in-law are both very, very involved, very dedicated grandparents, but also, to their credit, very hands-off. I mean, I think they saw me trying to get my first on a sleep schedule and, you know, doing all this cockamamie stuff, getting up with them, and I had been told by the lactation consultants that nobody could ever give him a bottle, not once, or else all my breastfeeding work would be ruined. So
really?
I had to get up with him. Yeah, I don't mean to smear every lactation consultant. They would not all be like this. But this one that I went to said, no bottle until they're at least 3 or 4 months old, or you will ruin everything. And so I believed that. And so, you know, I'm getting up. And he was, like I said, he was a refluxy baby. He only slept 45 minutes to an hour at a time. And so I was up with him all night, every night, and no, would not let anybody else take a turn because I was going to do it myself, and that's what the experts said. And, you know, I was coming unraveled there for a while, and my mother and my mother-in-law were supportive every way they could, and I'm sure thought that this was completely cockamamie, but they never said, you can't do it this way, you have to do this. They kind of let me come around to my own realization that maybe I didn't have to be so rigid. Maybe a little flexibility would be good for everyone. So they've been there every step of the way. And the grandfathers, you know, they're from a different generation where they didn't really change diapers. They didn't really do this. So they're thrilled to be parents, but they're not going to give me child-rearing advice because they were not involved in the same way.
Right. Well, how has writing the book impacted you personally?
This has become sort of a cause that I'm become sort of evangelical about, that we can turn our backs on all this stuff and be a better parent for it. The less hard we try to be perfect, the better moms and parents we are actually going to be. And so I try. That's not a lesson you can learn once, if you know what I'm saying. It isn't like I figured this out and I will never again overthink anything. Time and again, you just sort of relearn this lesson. But I have found it to be so profoundly helpful in my life to just be in the moment with my kids and just forget about all the stuff that truly doesn't matter. And being able to sort of share that with other mothers has been really wonderful for me. I mean, in a funny way, but this is something I feel strongly about, and it's been really, really wonderful to have this experience of getting to go around the country and, you know, read from the book and meet other women who kind of feel the same way and talk about how we can sort of climb out from underneath it.
Very interesting, because a lot of times, and you're right, because when you're in the moment, the flip side of that equation is that, oh my gosh, what's wrong with me?
Yeah, I think that's it. We all have these moments of self-doubt, and then most often we do think that we're alone in feeling this way. It isn't something that, it's not something the larger world wants to hear. It's not even something really our partners want to hear. And we do think we're alone in this. We get together with our other mother friends and we complain about, oh, you know, the baby's crying too much or whatever. But we usually don't say, I am deeply doubting myself. I really don't think I can handle this. I really don't know what I'm doing here. We don't tell our friends this because we're pretty sure we're the only ones who feel that way, even though everybody sitting there feels that way. And I'm pretty confident that that's the case now, having gone around the country and met so many women who have read this book and seen the play that I do say, yep, that's me.
What's the take-home value for the readers on this particular book?
that hopefully that you can, you know, you should never want what's best for your what's best if it gets in the way of just enjoying them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pretty soon this will be over. One day I'm going to be able to sit at my kitchen table and finish my coffee while it's still hot and read the newspaper, and my house will be so neat, and I'll look around and my children will be gone. They'll be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get back that peace and time to myself that I think I want, and it will be over. And when that time comes, I do
mm-hmm.
not want to look back and say, those were the most stressful days of my life. Those were the days that I yelled the most. Those were the days that I worried the most. I want to be able to look back on these days with my little kids and say, these are the happiest days of my whole life.
Right.
And that's
right.
up to me. That's really up to me whether or not I'm going to be able to say that.
Now, you know that you're going through this phase right now where you are the best thing that ever happened to your kids. The situation where they don't know anything at all. And then, of course, when they hit puberty, all of a sudden they found enlightenment. And everything starts to go a different route. And are you prepared for that just yet?
You're right.
You
I am in this sort
up?
Of phase. Somebody recently said to me that I'm between diapers and driving, that I... Unfortunately, my 2.5-year-old is not out of diapers. She should be. We're getting there. But you're right. In any moment now, I'm going to have nobody in diapers and nobody driving, which from people
mm-hmm.
who have been through it tell me is a sort of calm before the storm,
mm-hmm.
you know, blissful phase, kind of like the second trimester of pregnancy, I guess. It's really hard in the beginning, then it gets good in the middle for a while, and then it gets hard again at the end. It sounds like that's what being a mom's like, too. It gets okay in the middle, and then once they hit puberty, forget it. It's hard all over again for very different reasons.
Are you mentally prepared for it?
Oh, I don't know. I guess I better be, right? People have been saying to me, oh, I can't wait to read the book you're going to write then. So it sounds like it's quite an adventure. I better get myself ready.
Where can someone buy your book and keep up with your latest happenings?
Oh, well, you know, it's in all the bookstores. You can definitely buy it on Amazon, although I like to try to patronize the local indies. If you
mm-hmm.
go to a local independent bookstore these days, it's very easy for them to get something
right.
really overnight for you, you know, and so do that if you have one in your neighborhood. If not, then the big box stores or Amazon have plenty of copies.
And about finding out about the latest happenings about you, your website?
Oh, well, you know what, my I have a website, amywilson.com, that has lots of stuff about the book and the different book tour events that I'm doing, which is sort of winding down now. But I wrote this show, this one-woman show called Motherlode, which tours around the country, sort of similar to the book in that just it's the same sort of point of view, same sort of, I like to think, using humor to get a sort of a more serious point, that we got to let go of this stuff and live our lives and be happy. And that's going to tour the country again starting this fall. And you can go to that website is motherlodeshow.com,
mm-hmm.
and the load is spelled LOAD. And you can find out if the show's coming to your part of the country, and also put in a request for the show to come to your part of the country, which we do read and contact theaters in those areas and let them know that there's interest. So that does help.
Besides those... that, anything else on the horizon?
I am starting to work on a sitcom version of the book, believe it or not. Writing on a sitcom script that would be based on the book, and hopefully a second book. That's what's next for me. And you know, sort of more tales from the crazy house. The material is there. I think any parent can tell you this. The crazy, funny stuff happens every day. It's just a matter of getting the time to write it all down.
And what's interesting also, it applies to everyone. I mean, you did mention the fact that in your situation, of course, you have babysitters, you have the opportunity to get a maid to come in and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But in all actuality, being a mother is a mother. That's it.
That's true. I mean, I tried in this book to dwell as much on things that are universal and not my own experience. I mean, nothing about this book... You know, I don't think I'm some wonderful person because I was on the plane and my baby threw up at me 8 times or whatever. I tell that story because every mother has a story like that. Every mother has
right,
a story of
right.
some kid getting sick in a horribly inopportune place and everybody looking at you like you're a bad person. And these are stories that every mother can tell. And I like to think people enjoy this book and think it's funny because they say, exactly, that was exactly me. And then that was exactly what happened next. And then when my husband came home, this is exactly what he said. These are things that unite us, and the things that we worry about, you can be you can be a mom who works 50 hours a week, or you can be a mother who never, you know, never goes anywhere without your kid, and you're still going to worry
right.
about, is he sleeping right? Is he getting enough to eat? All these things that we're told to worry about, these are universal. These are insecurities that that bind all of us. And
well,
you know,
that's
motherly love, right? Right. And we're never going to stop worrying. If our children have, you know, enough to eat and a roof over their heads, we're going to find something to worry about. We're going to worry that they have too many cavities or whatever. There's going to be always something to worry about. But all that worrying doesn't make us a better parent, and it also might mean you miss the moment that's actually happening. At least that's what I worry about.
Motherly love transcends all cultures, and what it does to me, from my take, is the fact that it doesn't matter where you are, the basic fundamental things about wanting the very best for your child, that overrides everything else. And
that's right.
Different cultures have different approaches to things or what is the most important thing. And the basic fundamentals are food, knowledge, well-being, health. Those are the basic fundamentals. Everything else are based on circumstances, based on situations. That are
sure. Right. I mean, in some way, some people would say, well, we're lucky to even have these problems, which we are. I mean, I'm lucky to be able to be worrying about, should my son be taking soccer and baseball, or is that too much? These are good problems to have. I realize that. But they are the problems that many of us do have, and so it still means they're worth talking about and laughing at and
right.
exploring.
Right. So that's what I got out of the book, and the wonderful tender moment that you spent talking about the end of the book, which was very, very interesting, and like I was mentioning to you earlier about the fact that then, to me, it tied in about when it's all said and done, I see in the book the and I don't, again, this is my observation about you maturing as a mother,
mm-hmm.
going through the phases, and realizing that, hey, I'm not a bad mom.
Right.
I'm always good, because the fact is you're always good because you always try to do the best that you can. And that's
right.
All it is.
Right. That's all. But all your kids want is they don't want you to be the best mom you can be. They want you to be the mom who's there for them, who's not, you know, checking her BlackBerry every 10 seconds or reading the ingredient labels of every single thing in the supermarket. Just get down on the floor with them and play Legos, and it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay, even if it's not perfect. It might even be better if it's not perfect. That's what I'm coming to finally understand.
By the way, we're coming to the end of the show. Amy, do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners?
I do. Somebody said this to me recently, and I wish I had put it in the book, but I didn't hear it until recently. She said, you know, when you're faced with a difficult thing in your life, to say, this is not forever, this is just right now. And that just about bowled me over, and I thought, that's exactly right. And that is the recipe for living, especially when you're a parent. When something is going wrong, when your baby's up crying all night, when your son crashes the car, whatever it is we're going to face as parents, you take a deep breath. This is not forever. This is just right now. This is a difficult moment, and we are going to get through it. And on the other hand, when you're missing your children's adorable babyhood, saying, hurry up and let's go and finish your dinner and put your shoes on, you need to also take a deep breath and say, this is not forever. This is just right now. They're not going to color on the walls forever. This is the moment. So you can yell or you can laugh and get out the video camera, because this too will pass and it'll be over in an eye blink and you're going to miss it. And so now I do really try to live every day of my life that way, that this is precious. My kids, I already can't believe my son is oldest is 7.5 now. I'm not still little, but to me he just looks
right.
so big and so grown up, and it breaks my heart a little bit when I see how very tall he is and how grown up, and I just want to spend as much of this time in their lives as I can with them while they still want to be around me all the time. That doesn't last forever either. So that's my recipe for life. This is not forever. This is just right now. Savor the moment and take a deep breath if you need to.
Fantastic. Amy, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me for My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us this morning. Please join me next Tuesday morning as we continue with our series on how children honors and pay tributes to their mom for making a positive difference in their life. My guest will be Melissa Hart, author of Gringa, A Contradictory Girlhood. It is a tender and smart memoir of a coming-of-age journey after a parent comes out of the closet. Melissa and I will be discussing her fleeting moments with her mother and a touching and reflective look at a girl's struggle with the dichotomy of class, culture, and sexuality. For additional information about this show, future shows, and for my recipes for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great week.
Amy, thank you.
And have a great day.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.